For more information on ancient dragon Zengate and Taigen's teachings, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please click on the link for Just Give on our website.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome. So, for a couple of weeks into our spring practice period, and most of you here, not all, but the head student for this practice period is Douglas, and tonight is his first talk for practice period. So thank you very much for Douglas for taking on this talk.
Thank you. Good evening. There are lots of familiar faces, so I may just drone on all night. I have been told by several people now that it's very common, not mandatory, but very common for the head student's first Dharma talk to be a talk about how he or she came to practice and how he or she came to be here now. And I can't tell you that there's anything of particular narrative interest or drama about it. It's by now a fair number of years sitting facing a wall. Not a whole lot happens. Although I can say that there's a tension that's been going on or a development over my practice, and that is on a recurring basis, there's a tension between the mind that wants to treat Zazen as some sort of technique that's going to control and manipulate the mind in order to become calmer, become clearer, become happier, to figure things out. And the sort of greedy mind, and then the mind that's prepared to sit here and open to whatever this experience is without trying to change it. So there's been that, and just a growing appreciation of Sangha over my time practicing. From the beginning. I mean, I started in an almost cliched way, having gone to college. And feeling a certain spiritual, existential emptiness, not knowing, having a real feeling for what this life was all about, where I was going, what was important. And then the usual college kinds of things, having gone to school at a good public school in Montgomery, Alabama, moving to Hanover, New Hampshire to go to an Ivy League school, and running into people with very different backgrounds in a completely different environment. This is the first time I ever saw snow. Having worked very hard and been a fairly smart person to land in an environment where that was pretty much true of everyone else. And, you know, you have your first paper you write for your freshman writing seminar, and the professor gives you a C, good job. And you go, what is that? So all those are nice problems to have, but they're very real to you when you're going through them. And so there was a lot of anxiety. I had grown up to be grown up in the Presbyterian Church. And either shortly before or around the time I started in college, I realized, although I admired many Christians I knew who were very smart and intelligent, had really a profound understanding of their faith and lived really admirable lives, and I was very interested in Christian thought, had a pretty good knowledge of the scriptures, I sort of came to a realization that this was not my story anymore. And I wasn't sure what there might be that would be my story or what would guide my life. But I started reading, and it was the times, so I started reading about Eastern religions. And reading lots of Hindu stuff and reading Alan Watts and D.T. Suzuki especially, and other kinds of things like Be Here Now by Ram Dass, who's no longer remembered too much. But at any rate, all of those books were full of these explosive insights and transformations of the people, powerful insights into reality without explaining too much what that was, and really no guidance whatsoever about, okay, well, how do you do this? And there just weren't a whole lot of books out. This was, say, 1971, 1972. And if you wanted to practice Zen, you pretty much were needed to live in New York, San Francisco, or Los Angeles. And Hanover, New Hampshire didn't fall into any of those and wasn't even close to any of them. Meditation was kind of in the air. People talked about it a lot, but nobody actually did it. Although my freshman year, Transcendental Meditation, TM, started having a real presence. They would come on campus, and they'd have a special rate for students, which was $60 to have a little ceremony with the teacher, and you'd give him a piece of fruit, and you'd put it on his little altar, and he'd give you a mantra until you explain, 20 minutes twice a day, you sit with your eyes closed, don't move, recite your mantra. I didn't have $60, there was something about Transcendental Meditation that didn't do it for me, although I know people for whom it's been very meaningful, and at least two people have gone on to become members of the Department of Psychology at Maharishi University in Iowa, and that sort of thing. So not much happened along those lines until... The bookstore got copies of three books, for better or worse. One was Meditation in Action by Chogyam Trungpa, which I still recommend. It's a very small, wonderful book about meditation practice and carrying life off the cushion. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, Shunryu Suzuki, which I continue to read once or twice a year. But at that time, it was completely opaque to me. I don't know what it was. I mean, now I look at it and goes, yeah, okay, it makes a lot of sense to me. But back then, I read it and I don't have any idea what this was. The other book was Three Pillars of Zen by Philip Kepler, which was sort of the gateway to Zen for many, many people in this country. Philip Kaplow had practiced in Japan for years after having been a court reporter at the Nuremberg trials after World War II. He went to Japan. And Philip Kaplow is kind of famous. There's a story that goes around that gets into Zen books a lot. It's about the Western guy who goes with his buddy to visit a Zen master at a monastery, and he sees the Zen master bowing in front of all these statues, and he goes, well, what are you doing? You're a Zen master. This is all empty stuff. This is superstitious and all. You should spit on these statues. And the Zen master says, well, you spit and I'll bow. That was Philip Kaplow. And he practiced in a number of monasteries and then got involved with a lay group called Sambo Kyodan, the Three Treasures School, which is a lay movement, and Kaplow never ordained. Sambo Kyodan teachers, Harari Roshi, Yasutani Roshi, were famous for, they were koan schools, and they were famous for sort of a Rinzai style of practice from some of the really toughest monasteries, sort of cranked up a notch. So everybody, when you came to study with them, you'd be taught to count your breath, and then after you got a little settled down, you'd go see the Roshi, and he'd say, well, are you interested in being enlightened? And you'd go, this person that... What kind of question is this? This person has gone to the trouble to be here and to learn to count his breaths and so everybody'd say yes, and he'd say, okay, good, then you're going to get a koan. And the koan was almost always the Mu Koan, the classic one of, so a monk comes to the Zen master Joshu and asks in all seriousness, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu says Mu, which means no, nothing, sort of general negation in response to the question. And you would then go and practice reciting, as you would breathe, you would recite mu over and over and over until the idea was that you would have an a kinsho or a satori, an experience of seeing into your own nature. Usually, and this was described in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. I think, and looking back on it today, I think the first 100 pages of the book were fine for me. They were very informative.
Three pillars
of Zen, I'm sorry, yeah. After that, there are a lot of stories that enlightenment experiences and stories about sesshins run by Yasutani Roshi and Harada Roshi, which were pretty intense. It was very full of zazen that was bearing down as hard as you could, and lots of suffering and lots of pain, and even screaming mu all night at the top of your lungs, all night long, until you would have these breakthroughs. And when they talked about other meditation, Shikantaza, for example, Yasutani Roshi's description of it was you should practice Shikantaza with tremendous effort and energy, so at the end of a 20-minute period, you should be drenched with sweat, which is not quite our experience. And on the other hand, he'd say that, and then he'd say, well, you know, these Shikantaza was for the people who weren't interested in becoming enlightened. So, you know, he'd say, okay, you do this really hard and you'll get more stable and you'll get better concentration. And someday, after a really long time, you'll become enlightened. But the important thing, and for many, many people, I think, the reason Zen My Beginner's Mind was important was the book tells you how to do Zazen of that sort. And so I had the book, and I learned it, and I took it on wholeheartedly. And I have to say that I have, I'd grown up as a kid who'd worked really hard, been really smart. The way to resolve problems is to work really hard and figure them out. And so with my natural proclivities to hear about this kind of zazen, it's just kind of boring into your breath or boring into mu and trying really hard and getting drenched with sweat while you're doing it, really fed into everything in me. So, you know, after I'd worked and done my homework late at night and that sort of thing, I'd walk a couple of doors down from my dorm, and I'd go into the sanctuary of the United Church of Christ right there, and I'd sit cross-legged in the pews, and I'd count my breaths and be aware of my breath for a while. And I think there was a lot of value in it. I think that that kind of concentration practice can help to calm down your mind some, and no matter what, it's just the fundamental experience of that drifting away, being distracted and coming back, drifting away, coming back, over and over and over again, is valuable, although Kapler Roshi would never say, and what I would feel today, that that's the heart of Zazen, this coming back to this moment over and over again. It's not, Zazen is not some meditation object and your ability to concentrate on a meditation object. The meditation object is intended to bring you back here to be with this experience. But at any rate, so that experience just led to a lot of tension. So good things were coming from Zazen. There was a lot of tension as well. And I had to say that, you know, and I'd go, oh, I don't know about this. I've got Zen My Beginner's Mind. I've got Meditation in Action. And I'd read those and say, I must be, you know, I've got to be doing this wrong. I mean, this isn't working. I'm not particularly clear or calmer. And I'm not enlightened. So what's going on? And I finally did find a good bit of value in Meditation in Action, and finally looked at the notes in the back and noticed that Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, who wrote the book, had started a community in the little town of Barnet, Vermont, about an hour away from me. So I borrowed a car one day in summer and drove up there and dropped in unannounced, say, somebody needs to teach me to meditate. And they said, here, shell these peas. And after the work period, then somebody said, come on, and gave me good advice. on how to sit, and which was and something much more fruitful for me, which did not involve Zazen as wind sprints or something. I don't know. So I found much more value in that, and went back for some years to the community where Trungpa Rinpoche was living. It was then called Tale of the Tiger. Shortly later became Karma Choling. It still is Karma Choling. And when I first went, it was a simple farmhouse for an old dairy farm. And now, right while I was there, they said, okay, Trungpa Rinpoche was nothing if not an entrepreneur. And he decided, you know, I want to bring the Dharma to the West. I got to have a pretty big place. And so they went through this huge construction effort. And if you would go, you would work. And they had lots of residential staff who built it out. And it's a very large, impressive place on a beautiful piece of land with a mountain behind it. And they would have weekend programs and seminars, and people would come from all over the country. It was really very inspiring. And Trungpa Rinpoche was a wonderful speaker and a wonderful meditation teacher. He was also controversial because he drank a whole lot. And he was an incredible womanizer. And sort of a result of that was that some of the students on the day off, when they had those, had pretty crazy parties and an interesting social life. Notwithstanding some of the wild aspects on days off, it really was a very disciplined place. And Trungpa Rinpoche expected the people to practice hard. If you were a resident there, you sat for a couple of hours a day. You had your one or two day all days every month. Every year you were supposed to sit a datun, which was essentially a 30-day session where you sat for 8 or 10 hours a day, and you were expected to go on a solitary retreat in a cabin up on the mountain for 10 days. So, and study. Book learning. And so pretty serious people to stay there. And it was, I found it very valuable. I thought the practice there was very inspiring, not only because people sat a lot and were very serious, but because of the Tibetan emphasis on understanding Buddhist thought, which Trungpa Rinpoche didn't emphasize all that much, but he took pretty seriously. He'd been through a very traditional monastic education as an incarnate Lama Tulku. And so I continued to go back there, and then after I graduated from college, having learned to appreciate meditation a good bit, but not having discovered the direction of my life, I had no particular plans when they made me graduate from college, and I did things like work in kitchens and paint houses and work in refrigerated grocery warehouses and things like that. And that gives you lots of opportunities to practice. And I took particular advantage of that in Satadatun. The winter after I graduated. So, and that was great, you know. I mean, we have sessions here and they're inspiring. They're difficult, but they're inspiring. And if you're sitting 30 days, I think it's undoubtedly like, a real residential practice where you have a three-month practice period, something like that. Sitting that much, your mind settles down, it clears out, and sitting and opening to this moment and whatever is going on becomes something that just happens. Yeah, I don't think you can escape from it necessarily. Your mind can try to get away from it all at once, but it's going to come back to it. And I remember coming back and visiting friends and saying, what happened? And I said something along the lines of, you know, I think I have an idea of how my mind is supposed to be working. but I did not go move into Karma Choling. I ended up studying abroad for a while and then going to graduate school for a while and then finding other directions. And continued to practice essentially on my own once it wasn't easy to get to Karma Choling anymore. I did a certain amount of spiritual tourism, Not as much as some of the people here. I mean, you know, Kazan, our priest who runs the group in Albuquerque, has been to many more different places than I have, and Nyozan, for that matter. So since I didn't spend much time there and they had no particular impact on me, I'm going to ignore those. But so I eventually ended up in Chicago, went to law school, and then moved to St. Louis and joined the Missouri Zen Center, and that's an experience very much like what other people here have had. It was very small, and they would meet on Sundays in an Aikido studio, and then didn't get to do that anymore. And one of the members set up a zendo in his basement, and he built a tan, which we don't have, which is a platform all the way around the room, and you sit on the platform during zazen. And the teacher there, Rosan Yoshida, was a professor of Buddhist studies and religion at Webster College there. And he's an interesting guy. He had practiced with Koryo Saka at Tokyo University when he was an undergraduate, and then came to the United States and got his master's and doctorate at Columbia. So he studied with Kando Nakajima for some years and then moved to St. Louis to teach, and he became a student of Dainin Katagiri at the Minnesota Zen Meditation Center in Minneapolis, and he became his Dharma heir eventually. And then he spent 6 months at the Ryoji and also received transmission from Sugen Narasaki. And an interesting thing about Rosan was he was pretty hands-off, because although he was in charge of the group, he was the teacher, he ended up spending a lot of time, entire years teaching in Japan, and he was also very busy, although he was very dedicated to the group. So the Sangha ran things pretty much, which was an interesting experience. And it was interesting to, you know, practice with people who had spent a long time sitting. Rosan was also not particularly interested in talking about zazen. He was very, he was very influenced by Uchiyama Roshi. I don't know if anyone here's read Opening the Hand of Thought, which is a very good book about zazen, but I don't know. Maybe it's an exaggeration, but I would say Uchiyama's, it would be fair to say that for Uchiyama Roshi, whatever happens during zazen is really not your business. And so, it's just, don't get excited about that. Whatever happens, it happens, let it go. And so Rosan was kind of like that, and he didn't want to talk about that. He is very, very dedicated to peace work and environmental issues and social justice issues, and that's what he really wanted to talk about. He had and does have a really strong bodhisattva spirit. And I really appreciated practicing with those people. Eventually I got a new job and moved in 95 to Dallas, Texas. And there was no Soto Zen in Dallas at that time. And I found the Maria Kanon Zen Center, which was a really good thing. Maria Kanon has an unusual name because a teacher, Ruben Habito, is a former Jesuit who had gone to, and he is still a Christian while he practices Zen. He is a Zen master. And he has an interesting approach because he does not try to reconcile or translate one faith or kind of thinking into another. He would say that he practices across traditions. So if you go to Maria Kanon, I don't think you would have, I mean, there's just, no, it's all Buddhist Zen talk. But Ruben was from the Philippines, and he joined the Jesuits, and they sent him to Tokyo for his education, and he went to Sophia University and got his master's and his doctorate. But as soon as he got there, his spiritual advisor was Enumiya LaSalle, who was a priest who also was a Zen master. He'd been given authorization to teach by Koen Yamada Roshi, who was the head of the Sambo Kyodan, where Philip Kaplow started out. But Yamada Roshi's approach to Zen practice and to koan practice was very, very different. And Ruben's was too. Ruben was very much more like our Zazen with the addition of a koan. I'll just put it that way. Very much a matter of opening to this moment, opening to this experience with the Mu Koan and or subsequent koans as you studied it. And it was my first chance to really speak a lot with a teacher, and that was eye-opening. How important to this practice practicing with other people, with a teacher and with a sangha, is. And Maria Kanan was a pretty healthy, thriving place with a good many people and some people who'd been practicing for a long time. And I really appreciated the chance to, you know, have Dokusan and go in and present your understanding of a koan and then be told no. And then be able to ask questions or get hints about this. I think while I had certainly gotten a feeling at the Missouri Zen Center of further sitting, coming, waking up to this moment, sort of Soto Uchiyama style of Zazen, I think there was more and more of that as I practiced at Maria Kanon. And certainly, you know, eventually sort of really came to feel that, that experience of being here with, in this moment, with all barriers gone, as a real experience of this moment awakening in Zazen. And I think, you know, there was that and the ability to work with the Sangha there, the ability to be with people who'd practiced for a long time. And also Ruben's example, again, of Bodhisattva life, because he as well continues to be very actively involved in the community in Dallas and involved in peace work and social justice. He helps to organize a lot of relief work in the Philippines when there's they've had some terrible environmental tragedies there in particular. He's helped to organize that, and that's been very inspirational. Maybe it was the inclusiveness of Maria Kanon. It's Maria Kanon in reminding, sort of remembering the image of Maria Kanon that was developed in Japan during the persecutions of Christians when it became illegal to be a Christian, and there were all sorts of tests. You could be killed and tortured to death if you were a Christian. And so Japanese Christians hid, and one way they continued to practice their faith was they would have pictures of Kanon with Maitreya Bodhisattva as a baby being held in her arms. So it was a pietà statue, but the authorities didn't realize that, so it's traditionally been called the Maria Kanon. And Maria Kanon has always attempted to be very welcoming to people of all faiths, especially Christians. And they would do things like Sambo Kyodan has always had a lot of Catholic religious practice and authorized to teach And so Reuben would arrange for a priest to come to sessions or something like that. And so, you know, during the morning service, Catholics could go for Mass, that sort of thing. So really, very, very, very much appreciated working with Reuben for about 10 years. And that's about the same amount of time I've worked with Tigen. So I've been very lucky to have had that experience. I moved to Chicago. Reuben had a couple of recommendations for places to visit, which I didn't feel at home at when I got here, and learned somehow that Maria Kanon was at the Cenacle down in Lincoln Park, and dropped in and felt very, very much at home. I think partly because of the number of lay people in the practice, just a strong feel of, you know, Sangha. I felt very comfortable with Tigen. And some of the people who had helped to start Ancient Dragon were just really inspiring in their generosity and dedication to the practice, very much. I've been here, I guess it is 9 years, so 2007, that's when you came, right?
Yes.
I showed up at Ancient Dragon in the Cenacle very shortly after Tigen moved here. And this appreciation of opening to the experience of this moment has continued. That's an ongoing development. I am very, very grateful for the opportunity to have practiced with Tigen. I'm sure there are all sorts of virtues that a Zen teacher can have. But I just very much have appreciated the supportiveness and the example of dedication to practice. And the involvement with Sangha. Much more even than at Maria Kanon. The opportunity to help support the Sangha and help support Ancient Dragon has been tremendous. I think it's an important part of practice for us to be able to take this practice off the cushion and learn to work with others, work for others. It's an important value of our practice. That's why it's the Bodhisattva way. It's getting to be that time. That's pretty much the story for now. I don't know where things are going from here. I also very much appreciate this opportunity to be head student at the practice commitment period. I have really appreciated the chance so far to focus on the Lotus Sutra, which I appreciate very much. But the chance to spend time with other students and speak about practice, what's important to other people, what issues they have, what issues I have, has been fantastic. And so I very much look forward to more of that over the remainder of the practice commitment period. So I want to thank you very much for this opportunity. So.
Thank you, Douglas. Anyone have responses, comments, questions to Douglas?
So, thank you very much for sharing your history. I was curious, rumor has it that you have family, two sons, I think.
Yes.
Dog.
All of that.
Practice as an attorney, and I wondered what's the practice like woven into that part of your life?
You know, it's the practice is. It's a life like everybody else's life. I think there's a focus on, you know, engaging with whatever comes up and what's going on and what the issues are, what's next, you know. I wouldn't say following the schedule, because there's frequently not a schedule, And, you know, when you have very small children, when you have a baby, for example, doing zazen when you haven't had a whole lot of sleep is, you know, does anyone remember those old things that were really big in the 50s and early 60s? It was a bird that you would put, a little glass bird, like a woodpecker next to it. Yeah, and it would dip its beak into water, and then it would pop up and rock back and forth, and then it would go down and stick its beak in the water again. And that's what zazen is when you have a baby. Because it's just ba, ba, ba. I think my family has I taught my sons how to light incense and bow at the altar, and I tried to not teach them about Buddhism, but to certainly think about the fact that anything they did had consequences for other people. And I think they carry that with them. They really are admirable young men. And they're both adamant that there's no way they could possibly sit still for 30 minutes. So they're not really tempted by zazen, and my wife isn't either. But they have, I know they have recognized the importance of the practice to me. And so I don't think it's something they tolerate so much as they're supportive of. And I think it's, I think it's important for us to remember that lay people can practice Zen and find tremendous value in it.
I was actually thinking more about how you practice as a parent.
Oh.
It's infused with your dharmic practice.
I did not kill my children. it's yeah, I think families are that hothouse environment where everybody can push each other's buttons, and I think our practices allows us to see that sort of thing happening and to move beyond that. I think our practice lends, brings about over time a real, softening of the emotions and openness. So I think that is something I feel in my relationship with my sons and my wife. Not sure what else to say about that.
Maybe one more comment or question. Okay, two more. Well, okay, say thank you very much.
Thank you
for doing this. Thank you for sharing your story. I have so many. Ruben Devito's a good friend of mine, and we're maybe two of the only both academics and Zen teachers in America.
Yeah, I forgot to mention that. Ruben is a
engaged side. And,
yeah.
I'd forgotten. I've only met Rosan maybe once, but. He practiced, as you said, not at the same time, but with Nakajima Sensei, who I started with. So, I think I knew of him when I was practicing with Nakajima. So we have these, all of us have these tangled minds, Dogen calls it, just these ways in which our practice life is intertangled. So, thank you very much.
Thank you.